taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you were everyday Americans.
You know, it seems when people start talking about religious freedom rights, everyone from courts to politicians to everyday citizens starts screaming separation of church and state. I know several people, and probably several people in my audience right now are going, those words don't exist in the Constitution. And you're right. The words don't. But the concept, the idea of separation of church and state does exist in the First Amendment, just not the way most people use it. And certainly not the way courts around the country apply it. I've talked many times before about the fact that the First Amendment limits the powers of Congress. The first five words are, Congress shall make no law. So we're not talking about the idea of how far the First Amendment applies. We're specifically talking about this idea of separation of church and state, how it is supposed to be applied, and what this means for the way it's currently applied today. Hello there, everyday Americans. Welcome to the Constitution Study. I'm Paul Engel. I'm glad you could join me today. And I want to start today off with a Supreme Court case that was recently opined on that deals not just with freedom of religion, but in this case, also freedom of speech, specifically religious speech. When is flying a flag government speech? That was the question before the Supreme Court in the case Shurtleff et al. Versus City of Boston. Could the city of Boston refuse to fly a Christian flag? Was the city required to do so? Or did Harold Shurtleff have the right to fly the flag of his choice on public property? What does this mean for other freedom of speech cases around the country? This case all started with a policy the city of Boston adopted in 2005. Reading from the court's opinion, just outside the entrance to Boston City Hall on City Hall Plaza stand three flagpoles. Boston flies the American flag from the first pole and the flag of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts from the second. Boston usually flies the city's own flag from the third pole. But Boston has, for years, allowed groups to hold ceremonies on the plaza during which participants may hoist a flag of their choosing on the third pole in place of the city's flag. Between 2005 and 2017, Boston approved the raising of about 50 unique flags for 284 such ceremonies. Most of these flags were other countries, but some are associated with groups and causes, such as the Pride flag, a banner honoring emergency medical service workers, and others. Sounds like a nice public relations program. Allow groups to hold ceremonies in the plaza and raise a flag on one of the flagpoles. Now, for 12 years, everything was fine. Well, that was for 12 years. In 2017, Harold Shurtleff, the director of an organization called Camp Constitution, asked to hold an event on the plaza to celebrate the civic and social contributions of the Christian community. As part of that ceremony, he wished to raise what he described as the Christian flag. Sure enough, once someone is asked to raise that scary Christian flag, the problems start. The commissioner of Boston's Property Management Department worried that flying a religious flag at City Hall could violate the Establishment Clause and found no past instances of the city's having raised such a flag. He therefore told Shurtleff that the group could hold an event on the plaza but could not raise their flag during it. Shurtleff and Camp Constitution petitioners sued, claiming that Boston's refusal to let them raise their flag violated, among other things, the First Amendment's Free Speech Clause. Like many in governments from federal to local, including the Supreme Court of the United States, Boston's Property Management Department has a serious misunderstanding not only of the Establishment Clause, but the First Amendment as a whole, which reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Let's start with the first five words. Congress shall make no law. Congress is the proper noun for the national legislature, as established by Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1 of the Constitution of the United States. All legislative power herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. Since the law allowing the flying of flags over Boston City Hall Plaza was not created by Congress, and since the city of Boston is not a part of the federal government,
it cannot violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. What the city of Boston should have been concerned with was Articles 2 and 46 of the Massachusetts Constitution. Article 2 reads, "It is the right as well as the duty of all men in society, publicly and at stated seasons, to worship the Supreme Being, the great creator and preserver of the universe. And no subject shall be hurt, molested, or restrained in his person, liberty, or estate for worshiping God in the manner and season most agreeable to the dictates of his own conscience, or for his religious profession or sentiments, provided he doth not disturb the public peace or obstruct others in their religious worship." And Article 47 reads, "No law shall be passed prohibiting the free exercise of religion." Now, since Mr. Shurtleff claimed a violation of the Constitution of the United States, his case was heard in federal court. The district court held that flying private groups' flags from City Hall's third flagpole amounted to government speech, so Boston could refuse petitioner's request without running afoul of the First Amendment. The First Circuit affirmed. Which brings us to the case we're reviewing today. The question the Supreme Court was reviewing was whether or not the district court was correct. Was flying a flag from City Hall's flagpole government speech or not? See, if it was government speech, then the government had the right to control what was being said. If it was not government speech, then the city of Boston had violated Mr. Shurtleff's rights by denying him his free speech. The boundary between government speech and private expression can blur when, as here, the government invites the people to participate in a program. Applying this government speech analysis here, the court finds that some evidence favors Boston and other evidence favors Shurtleff. The history of flag flying, particularly at the seat of government, supports Boston. The question remains whether, on the 20 or so times a year when Boston allowed private groups to raise their own flags, those flags, too, express the city's message. In general, when a government flies a flag, it is expressing a message. For example, the flying of a flag of another country means a foreign leader is visiting, while flying a flag at half-staff conveys a message of sympathy or somber remembrance. However, what happens when the government is not the one choosing the flag? The circumstantial evidence of the public's perception does not resolve the issue. The most salient feature of this case is that Boston neither actively controlled these flag raisings nor shaped the message the flags sent. To be sure, Boston maintained control over the event's date and time to avoid conflicts, and it maintained control over the plaza's physical premises, presumably to avoid chaos. But the key issue is whether Boston shaped or controlled the flag's content and meaning. Such evidence would tend to show that Boston intended to convey the flag's message as its own. And on that issue, Boston's record is thin. Boston had told the public that it sought to accommodate all applicants, though apparently that did not extend to religious applicants. Because the flag-raising program did not express government speech, Boston's refusal to let the petitioners fly their flag violated this free speech clause of the First Amendment. When the government does not speak for itself, it may not exclude private speech based on religious viewpoint. Doing so constitutes impermissible viewpoint discrimination. Since the city of Boston had, among other things, specifically sought to accommodate all applicants, denying one simply because of their religious viewpoint violates the free speech clause. Not of the First Amendment, as Justice Breyer claims, but Article 77 of the Massachusetts Constitution. The liberty of the press is essential to the security of freedom in a state. It ought not, therefore, be restrained in this commonwealth. The right of free speech shall not be abridged. I'm happy for Mr. Shurtleff. He got the correct answer, even if it was based on the wrong law. The city of Boston had violated Mr. Shurtleff's freedom of speech. It's just that since it was the city of Boston and not Congress who passed the law, it was a violation of the Constitution of Massachusetts and not the United States that Boston violated. What does this mean for the rest of the country? Once again, the Supreme Court has substituted their own opinion for the supreme law of the land. While the outcome may have been the correct one, how can we trust that the court will get it right the next time? In the meantime, other government facilities should see that viewpoint discrimination is a violation of a person's freedom of speech. This opinion was focused on the participation of religious viewpoints in public displays. The city of Boston uses flags, but what other public displays could this impact? If a city park can be used by groups to put up displays, can they deny a church the right to put up a nativity scene? Can a public school deny the saying of the Pledge of Allegiance because of the words One Nation Under God or the singing of Christmas carols? If the critical distinction is who controls the display, then the use of public property for religious displays shouldn't raise a constitutional issue. I only hope that future government actors will recognize this fact.
But what we have here, at least initially at the city of Boston, is a classic misunderstanding of this concept of separation of church and state. We get that phrase from a letter that Thomas Jefferson sent to a group of Baptists in Danbury, Connecticut. Let me give you the more detailed story. After winning his election in 1800, there are several people sent letters to Thomas Jefferson, including a group of Baptists in Danbury, Connecticut. And you have to understand that because the First Amendment focuses on Congress, states were still allowed to have state churches, and in fact, many of them did, and the predominant church in Connecticut at the time, I believe, was Congregational, not Baptist. So the Baptists sent this letter to Mr. Jefferson, congratulating him on his win, and expressing some concern about their ability to freely exercise their religion. Our sentiments are uniformly on the side of religious liberty, that religion is at all times and places a matter between God and individuals, that no man ought to suffer in name, person, or effects on account of his religious opinions, that the legitimate power of civil government extends no further than to punish the man who works ill to his neighbor. But, sir, our constitution of government is not specific. Our ancient charter, together with the laws made to coincident with therewith, were adopted as the basis of our government at the time of our revolution, and such has been our laws and usage, and such still are, that religion is considered as first object of legislation, and therefore what religious privileges we enjoy as a minority part of the state, we enjoy as favors granted and not as inalienable rights. See, the Danbury Baptist noted the Constitution wasn't specific. And the Constitution of Connecticut put the power of religion control in the legislature, at least the historical laws, I should say, not the Constitution of Connecticut, the historical laws. And they were concerned that whatever freedom of religion they have, since it came from the state, was controlled by the state. Now, Jefferson replied in a nice letter, and he thanked them for their concern. But he went on to say, believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach action only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. So we see the wall that Jefferson was referring to was to prevent the government from interfering with the church, not the other way around. Now, interestingly, this letter, when it was used in court, first was noted as a letter of Jefferson's opinion. It's not law, it's not constitution, it's not doctrine, it is his opinion. It also included the entire letter, putting everything in context. It wasn't until, I believe, sometime in the 1970s, we started seeing the phrase separation of church and state being taken out of context, not noted that it was a letter from Jefferson, not put in the context of what he was saying, not only what he said, but what he was replying to. And it is this misunderstanding of the separation of church and state that has been so ingrained in the American people, well, that a property manager in Boston thinks the mere idea of a religious flag appearing on government property somehow violates the First Amendment. This is why I believe John Jay was so adamant that every member of the state ought diligently to read and study the Constitution of his country, as well as teach the rising generation to be free. So we have an understanding of these things, rather than this legal game of telephone. You know, one person says, this is what I think, and it goes to the next person, and next person, and next person, to the point where nowadays, most people who use the separation of church and state phrase don't even know where it comes from, don't even know what it means. Sadly, many of them include attorneys, judges, and I believe even justices of the Supreme Court. So as we go through the rest of the program, keep that in the back of your mind. When we're referring to this idea of separation of church and state, it is meant to keep the state out of the church's business, not to prevent any religious expression from showing up in public venues, on public property, or in public displays. Because the very same Jefferson that came up with the phrase, a wall of separation between church and state, attended Sunday morning church services in our nation's capital. This was not odd, by the way. It was routine for many years for the capital to be used as for church services because it had the seating capacity. Now, I have to take a break, but before I do, I want to remind you to check out constitutionstudy.com, find all the work that we're doing there, all the work that we're doing on the Constitution Study. This radio program is just one of the platforms, one of the tools that we use to help educate the American people. You can find out more, again, at constitutionstudy.com. Also, please head over to healthycell.com. Now, one of the things I've learned spending many, many years traveling is that it's easy to get sick. And one of the best ways to prevent that is to support your immune system. So I use Immune Super Boost from Healthy Cell. It supports the immune system with over a dozen immune supplements and one travel-ready gel pack. As an America Out Loud listener, they'll give you 20% off your first order. Just use that code out loud at checkout. So once again, go to healthycell.com, put whatever thing you want in your order, whether it's the Immune Super Boost or anything else, use the code out loud at checkout for 20% off that first order.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health four times a day. That's 120 times per month. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains full effective doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day, pill-free, ultra-absorption ingestible gel. It tastes great, comes in a convenient squeeze gel pack, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com. HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
We wouldn't go a day without washing our hands, brushing our teeth, and washing our nose. Whoa, wait, we wash our nose? Yes, the number one place where bacteria, viruses, and pollen enter the body is through the nose. So the average person breathes over 23,000 times a day. That's 23,000 opportunities for bacteria, viruses, and irritants to get into your nose and make you sick. For an extra layer of protection, wash your nose with Clear. That is Clear, X-L-E-A-R. Clear's drug-free nasal spray features xylitol, an ingredient proven to block adhesion of many nasty bacteria and viruses, and effectively clean, not just rinse like a saline, but wash your nose. Clear nasal spray quickly alleviates congestion, opens your airway, and ensures your body's natural defenses are strong. Read the research studies for yourself at clear.com. That's X-L-E-A-R.com. Protect yourself from the pathogens and junk you breathe. Pick up a bottle for you and your family today.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study, where today we're talking about separation of church and state. And I think we set a good stage. We looked at the Boston case and the fact that the Supreme Court said, listen, this is not government speech. Flying a flag, if the government doesn't always control what flag is chosen. They're not the ones choosing the flag. It's not government speech. Therefore, they have freedom of speech, even if it's religious speech. We use that as a starting off point to get a better understanding of where this concept of separation of church and state came from, what it was originally meant, the idea that the state could not climb the wall to interfere with religion, to interfere with the church. And we talked a little bit about how that we went from the original understanding, the idea that the government couldn't interfere with the church, to this idea of the government can't even do anything that acknowledges the church. Any view of religion in government opinions, government practices, is somehow verboten by a First Amendment law that says no such thing and, by the way, affects primarily or only Congress and the federal government. Now, there's still plenty of opportunities for freedom of speech to be infringed on, but I'm trying to focus on those that would fall under this banner of separation of church and state. For example, the Biden administration put together another mandate. I've talked to you before, mandates are generally unconstitutional. But they did. They said they wanted to force all employers to pay for sex change surgeries, period. They did not provide any sort of conscience or religious exemption. Well, needless to say, somebody sued. In this case, it was the Christian Employers Alliance out of North Dakota, and they brought suit with the assistance of the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm not associated with Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm not supported by them, but they do a lot of good work. So you can find out more at, I believe it's ADF.org. But Alliance Defending Freedom are the lawyers. Christian Employers Alliance, CEA, are the plaintiffs. And they complained. And a North Dakota district judge, Daniel Traynor, he's in the, the District of North Dakota, took a look at the suit, and he realized that it is likely that CEA will win the suit, that they have a point. They cannot be forced to violate their religious beliefs. Now, remember, the First Amendment, the freedom of religion, actually is contained in two clauses. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. By mandating that somebody violate their conscience, violate their beliefs, violate their religion, the Biden administration is infringing on the free exercise of religion. Free exercise is not simply the ability to do something, it's the ability to decide not to do something. So Judge Traynor took a look at this, said, you know what? He believes that the Christian Employers Alliance is likely to win the suit. So he issued a temporary restraining order, a temporary injunction that prevents the Biden administration from enforcing the mandate while the lawsuit moves forward. Now, reading from the judge's order, the EEOC is enjoined from interpreting or enforcing Title VII of the Civil Rights Act against the alliance in a manner that would require its present or future members to provide insurance coverage for gender transition surgeries, or I should say services. The EEOC is enjoined from applying or enforcing these same regulations against insurers and third-party administrators of the alliance's present and future members. HHS is enjoined from interpreting or enforcing Section 1557 of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, and any regulations against the alliance present or future members in a manner that would require them to provide, offer, perform, facilitate, or refer for gender transition services. HHS is enjoined from interpreting or enforcing Section 1557 of the ACA and implementing regulations against the alliance's present or future members in a manner that prevents, restricts, or compels the alliance's members' speech on gender identity issues. So there are 4 points, two against the EEOC, two against HHS. And it basically says, listen, at this point, you are not allowed, neither the EEOC or HHS. It's interesting. The EEOC is looking at Title VII of the Civil Rights Act to determine the need to provide for gender transition services. It says you can't do that. You neither can you set regulations on insurers or their third parties, administrators. And the HHS is not allowed to enforce Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act. I want you to notice something here, though. This is important. It often gets lost. It's not a question of separation of church and state. But notice that the EEOC and HHS are only enjoined against acting against members of the alliance. Everyone else is fair game. There's not a nationwide injunction against employing these, requiring these gender transition surgery or insurance coverage and payments. That is how courts work. The court has no authority except over the parties to the case in front of it. That is a limitation. So I haven't read the entire order, but in looking at this so far, it seems like a pretty decent order. It is limited, it is focused, and it deals with a serious situation that if it takes months or even years possibly for this case to go through all of its, not simply its hearing, but the appeals that come from it, there are certain long-term damages that could not be recovered from, so the court has issued an injunction in this case. Good call. And again, in my opinion, this is a good call. This is well done. But it shows, we want us to understand, what you have is the Biden administration prohibiting anyone from not performing or not paying for certain procedures based on their religious belief. Now, here's the interesting thing, because they invoked a religious exemption. How about just plain conscience? You know, I don't want to get into the debate of religious versus secular, but think about it. What if it's just your conscience? What if it's not your church or your whatever manner of faith you follow? What if your conscience just says, why am I paying for your elective surgery? Doesn't go there. But this is, again, we're talking today about separation of church and state. That's why I picked that particular case. Now, there's another case, this one coming out of Minnesota. You see, the Mayo Clinic is being sued for firing workers for their failure to comply with an order to be a medical experiment. Now, this is anticipated to be the first in many, many cases, because while this suit, which was filed earlier in May in federal court in Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic runs clinics in several states, and they're expecting a lot more suits. But in this case, a nurse, Shelley Keel, says she was the subject of religious discrimination because Mayo denied her request for a religious exemption from a mandate, even though she could have done all of her work remotely. Now, this particular case and several others bring up a very interesting issue. You see, the Mayo Clinic is a private corporation. They're not part of government. So they have the ability to set rules and standards for their employees. It's their property. The business is their property. The job is their property. They have the right to set the rules for employment. But there's a problem here. You see, as I understand it, the Mayo Clinic implemented its mandates because of a mandate created by Washington. In other words, they simply didn't come up with this rule on their own. It was a regulation that was promulgated. We have this little thing called Title 42, Section 1983 of the United States Code, which reads, every person who, under color of any statute, ordinance, regulation, custom, or usage of any state or territory or District of Columbia, subjects or causes to be subjected any citizen of the United States or other person within the jurisdiction thereof to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the Constitution and laws shall be liable to the party injured in an action of law, suit in equity, or other proper proceedings for redress. That's a lot of legal mumbo jumbo. What does it say? If any person either causes or subjects someone to be caused to a deprivation of rights secured by the Constitution, based on any ordinance, regulation, custom, law, usage, they can be sued in federal court. That's where this comes from. See, the Mayo Clinic didn't simply come up with this COVID mandate all on its own. It was implementing based on a regulation that came out of Washington. They deprived people of their rights. Now, it's interesting is this has a question of religious exemptions. This case is based, you know, Ms. Keel said she asked for a religious exemption and she was denied pro forma a religious exemption, therefore denied a right protected by the Constitution of the United States. This is interesting because it's going to come down to, well, it's going to come down to, was the Mayo Clinic or the Mayo Company, was it following a regulation from Health and Human Services or wherever the vaccine mandates were coming from? Or was it acting on its own? And what proof is there of either case, right? Because if the Mayo Clinic was acting on its own, well, then they can't be sued under Section 1983. If, on the other hand, they were not acting on their own, but they were acting under a regulation of the United States, well, then they can be sued under 1983. But you see, there's more. You see, there's this other law called Title 18, Section 242 of the United States Code that says, whoever, under color of any law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom, willfully subjects any person in any state, territory, commonwealth, possession, or district to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured or protected by the Constitution or laws of the United States, it goes on to a couple of other things, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 1 year or both. You see, Title 42, Section 1983 deals with lawsuits, suits at equity, whereas Title 18, Section 242 deals with crimes, criminal charges. That means that the same people that are being sued under 1983 may be actually charged with federal crimes. Now, I truly do not expect that to happen, right? Because it almost never does. Do you really expect the federal government, a U.S. attorney, to charge people at a private company with committing a federal crime that was instigated by their boss in the White House? Somehow, I really don't think that's going to happen. However, I certainly would like to see complaints being filed. I don't know the legal process. Maybe there's a lawyer that's listening. You can tell us, what is the legal process for having an action under 18 U.S.C. 242? What is the process for, is there a complaint that gets filed? Does it get filed with the FBI, with the U.S. Attorney's Office? I'm actually curious. I would like to see what the process is because it's our rights. See, if these... And by the way, this Nurse Keel is not the only person suing. There's actually a couple of suits going on. There's another suit by Sherry Hyde. I think I'm pronouncing that right. I hope so. I'm sorry. She filed a suit. Interesting, because she received her religious exemption from the vaccination mandate, but was denied one for a testing mandate. So in other words, she received, as I understand it, she received a religious exemption from taking the shot, but was forced to test weekly for COVID-19. Now, the COVID-19 tests are also emergency use authorizations. They are not FDA approved. They're not FDA licensed. So she asked for a religious exemption, and she was denied. Her request was rejected. But what we have here, and again, I expect many, many more. But here's the question, is if these ladies win their equity suits, is someone going to be charged with a crime? Because if these ladies win, the Mayo Clinic is going to pay damages. Right? Whatever they're awarded, legal fees, punitive damages, compensatory damages, whatever, will be paid for by the Mayo Clinic. Under 1983, but under 18 U.S.C. 242, the people who did this face fines and possibly a year in jail. Because it says, whoever under color of any law, statute, ordinance, yada, yada, yada. See, if we actually applied the law, not just lawsuits, but the actual criminal law in these cases, perhaps some of these entities, some of the people at these companies would be a little more hesitant to infringe on the rights of their neighbors, their employees, even their customers, knowing that it may not just be the company that pays the bill, that they may be tasked with paying the bill. I don't think this is an either or. It's not a 1983 or a 242. I think we need to use both. Because I think the Mayo Clinic should pay damages to the people they have harmed. But I also think the people at the clinic who violated the rights of others, who denied willfully the rights of others, should pay as well. There should be some punishment personally for the mistakes that they made. Now, I have to take another break, but before I do, consider this. Independence Day is fast approaching. Notice I called Independence Day, not the 4th of July, because everybody has a 4th of July, but only in America is a 4th of July Independence Day. The day we declared independence, that liberty, freedom, rights mattered. So I can think of no better time to actually study the Declaration of Independence and probably the Constitution as well. Now, if you want to find out more, go to constitutionstudy.com and you'll find copies of or links to the Declaration of the Constitution. But consider this. Last year, I wrote an article called The Redeclaration of Independence, where I took a look at the Declaration of Independence and applied it, instead of to King George, to Washington, D.C. And every grievance we had in 1776 against King George, you can claim today against Washington, D.C. Today would be a good day to decide maybe we want to redeclare our own independence.
While many things we hear are lies, we know one thing is true. Viruses exist and people get sick. Look, there's no guaranteed way to keep from getting sick, but there is a way to reduce your chances. Cofix RX, the original povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray that you hear Dr. McCullough talking about, provides an additional, invisible layer of protection from colds, flu, coronaviruses, and more. Click the banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and use promo code OUTLOUD for 20% off. Stay protected with Cofix RX.
Surely if you can't find it here, you can't find it anywhere. We are the pulse and voice of everyday American thought. So you can listen in on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. That's right, you joined the Constitution Study. Today we're talking about separation of church and state, this mantra that has been through our nation since, well, pretty much since I was a child. I seem to remember this idea of separation of church and state and the misuse of this phrase from Thomas Jefferson. To recognize that the wall of separation he talked about was to protect the church from the state, not the other way around. Now, there's a reason why the focus has to be on protecting the church from the state. You see, the church cannot make the state do anything. The church doesn't have the force of arms. The church doesn't have control of the wallet. The church cannot walk into a a government office and demand things happen. However, the state may not have the legal authority, but it has the physical capability to walk into a church building and demand certain things. We saw this during COVID when government actors tried to shut down churches, and the vast majority of them simply rolled over to get their belly rubbed. Yes, there were a couple of churches in California that stood up. And of course, the most famous was the Polish pastor in Canada, who referred to the goons that were trying to shut down his service as the Nazis they were. But what happens if we sit back and we watch while government actors tell the church what to do? And I don't just mean the organization. I don't just mean the congregation, the denomination. I mean tell you what you must do regardless of your religious beliefs. You see, after this leak of the draft opinion in Roe v. Wade, well, states have been going pell-mell either to protect abortion or to stop abortion or somewhere in the middle. And among those has certainly been Congress. Congress has gone pell-mell to try and force a truly dystopian abortion rights law. See, they wanted to go, they say they want to codify Roe v. Wade, but what they really want to do is say, no, the state never has the authority, much less the responsibility, to protect life in the womb. Now, part of this was an attempt to, I believe, to shut down many of the pro-life laws that have been enacted in states, Texas, Florida, Mississippi, and others. But what's interesting is there was no religious exemption. You see, part of this move included the ability, as I've been told, to force doctors to perform abortions throughout the country, even if it was a violation of their faith, even if it was a violation of their conscience. You see, the interesting thing about the First Amendment, when you step back and look at it as a whole, is you're dealing with a person's conscience, their religion. What are their beliefs? What is their worldview? How do they view the world? Speech, their ability to communicate with others, both, again, via speech and via press, the ability to print and publish, to gather together with like-minded people, and then to petition a government for a redress of an infringement on their rights. Conscience. We used to respect conscience in this country, and it seems to be on the outs. And that's the part of this legislation I want to look at. It's not, I can spend plenty of time talking about abortion, and I can spend plenty of time talking about the anticipated decision in Roe and the Congress's response to it. But I want you to stop and think about this for a moment. The legislation that Democrats proposed in the Senate would have removed any state conscience protections against performing abortions. If you were a doctor, if you invested hundreds of thousands of dollars and years of your life to become a physician, if you took the oath, the Hippocratic oath, that said, first, do no harm, if you objected to performing abortions, either in part or in whole, because in your heart of hearts, you knew it was wrong, you knew you were taking a human life, there are those in Congress, almost half of the Senate, says, that doesn't matter. Your viewpoint, your conscience must serve at our behest. And our behest is the ability to kill babies. I don't know how history will look back at the United States at this time. Will it look back the way we look back at Nazi Germany and the atrocities committed in that country? Or will it look at it differently? I don't know. What I do know is there's a difference between saying you must have the ability to get an abortion and we must force someone else to give it to us. So I do a class called What is a Right? And I go into it a lot of detail, but I want to sum something up in the time we have left. See, when I ask what is a right, there's a lot of details, but for you to legitimately exercise a right, it cannot infringe on the rights of another. That's a fundamental understanding. If you want to understand rights and their application, you start with recognizing no matter what rights you have, you cannot use them to infringe on the rights of another. See, that's where I'm coming to here. Even if there was a right to abortion, which I contend there cannot be, because you're talking about taking a human life, and the 5th and 14th Amendment prohibit that. You cannot take a life without due process of law. But let's put that aside for a moment and say, okay, what if we were to concede that there may be a situation, there may be a place where a person has a right to abortion. Do you have the right to force somebody to give you that abortion? You see, even when you go, when you follow them down the extreme, and again, I don't. Now, I contend that life begins at conception. I could easily debate that with others, but I will, you know, I might have a debate about that. I'd be willing to say once life is detected, the Constitution says it must be protected. You cannot deprive someone of life without due process of law. But Paul, what about the woman's rights? Well, see, rights come with consequences. Pregnancy is rarely the act of forced on a woman. We've been told for decades about the need for education in schools so that children can have, or people can have, safe sex. Sex without worrying about the consequences such as diseases and pregnancies. There's a consequence for your actions. Now, a situation where the life of the mother is at stake, well, then you have a due process, right? If there is evidence that the mother's life is at stake, or serious physical harm to the mother if the pregnancy isn't terminated, it's a terrible decision. But again, one person's rights cannot be used to infringe on another's. I can't imagine being in that situation. I pray I never know anyone who is in that situation. But at least there's a logical standard there. But to go beyond that, to say not only can you have can you kill the child in the womb whenever you want, for whatever reason you want, but I'm not going to allow someone to say, I don't want to be the one that does it. That is the dystopian future. That is government ruling your life. That is government telling you, you don't get to decide anymore. You must do what we say when we say it, period, end of story. I don't know about you, but even setting aside the question of abortion, do you want to live in a realm where you are told what you must do? You are told you have to perform this regardless of your conscience. You're not allowed to be a conscientious objector. Do you want to live in a country where your conscience doesn't matter? Where what you believe doesn't matter? See, when they talk about freedom of religion, it's based on a person's belief. Now, granted, early in this country, it was almost entirely Christian, the vast majority. But even then, The founding fathers looked and said, even among Christians, we believe slightly differently. We must protect a person's right to believe differently, not just in their hearts, but in their actions, in private and in public. This abuse of the phrase, the separation of church and state, has been used to deny people the right to freely exercise their religion. This Boston case is one of I hope to be several more, that recognize the fundamental precept that you have a right to your conscience, and you have a right to not be forced to violate it. See, that's the idea of freedom, is the ability to disagree, to allow someone to have a different point of view. If we do not protect, not simply religion in the mainstream concept, but this idea of conscience, if we don't protect that, we don't have freedom. Because if you're telling me that your right to believe differently, your right to think differently is not, it's not worth protecting, where does that leave us? Benjamin Franklin, writing as Silas Duguid, said, without freedom of thought, there can be no such thing as wisdom. Your conscience, your ability to think as you wish, to hold your own opinions, to hold yourself to your own standards. Without that, there can be no such thing as wisdom. Frank went on, and no such thing as public liberty without freedom of speech. If you're not allowed to express what you think. See, there's a logical line there, right? You have the thought, turns into the word, turns into the expression. Whether it be spoken or printed, without freedom of speech, you cannot have public liberty. Think about that when you're seeing governments trying to prevent people from holding certain thoughts, or from expressing certain thoughts, or acting in certain ways. Because Franklin went on, he said, there's no public liberty without freedom of speech, which is the right of every man as far as by it he does not hurt or control the right of another. And this is the only check it ought to suffer, and the only bounds it ought to know. Those are the only limitations we should allow on our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom of press. These are the cornerstones upon which freedom and liberty and, yes, wisdom are built. And too many Americans have stood by while those cornerstones have been eroded, been chiseled, been broken, been torn down. I may not agree with the pro-abortion side. I may not agree with a lot of people on a lot of things. But that doesn't mean I want them silenced, or that I'm saying their beliefs, their conscience, have no place in public discourse. That is the distinction we need to make. I can disagree with somebody without shutting them down. Now, as I mentioned before, we are approaching Independence Day. It's a good day to sit and think about what was fought for. You know, millions of people have fought and bled and died to protect the Constitution, protect your freedom, your liberty. Are you willing to give that up? Or are you willing to fight for it? Now, the best place to start, before you pick up any tool, you should have some education. There's a couple of organizations that I think can help. By the way, they're not paying for any advertising. I just think these are great organizations. One is the 917 Society. They're working hard to put a copy of the Constitution in the hand of every eighth grader in the country. You can find them at the 917 Society, the numerals, 917society.org. If you can volunteer or support them, that'd be wonderful. I've already mentioned the Constitution Study, but there are other groups that have, they have different tools, curriculum, books, videos. So check out the Institute on the Constitution. You can find them at theamericanview.com. You can use their resources. They have great classes. They have online videos. These are tools that they use, again, to help people read and study the Constitution, to restore the constitutional republic from the bottom up through grassroots education. These are a couple of the organizations that I deal with to help educate the American people. But regardless of whose tool you use, regardless of what program you may find, if you can share this information, share it with friends, share it with family. Take these episodes as they come up on the website. You can find them on AmericaOutloud.com. Take the articles and videos off the Constitution Study. Take the podcasts and share them. Help to open the minds of others. Help to express ideas. Help to encourage freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of expression. Because if you want to secure the blessings of liberty, it takes more than just being a keyboard warrior. It takes more than just sitting back and tiss-tissing at what's going on. It takes the time and the effort to share. And when you do that, you're helping to spread the blessings of liberty.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail. Love.